Hello and welcome to the next episode of Lost in Criterion. I'm John Patrick Oatari-Dorgan, and with me, as always, is a man whose menage a trois only includes British men.
I am the Adam Glass, and it's really disappointing that it only includes British men because it means it doesn't include Gary Cooper.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's unfortunate, but you are authentic to the true source material. Your menage a trois is all effete British men.
Oh man, I would so much rather have a poly relationship with the people in Design for Living than with the actors in the British television.
The British television,
No Coward,
like the British television No Coward
we watched
thing was so like it's kind of overwhelming, and like just to get this right out of the door right away, like it's kind of overwhelming how much better the Lubitsch film is than the play production. Of the British, like the British BBC play production. It's like that. Some of that has to do with obviously like film versus TV, right? But we, like, as we talked about with like when we did all those, what were those called? I forget the TV movies we watched. I forget what the term was for those.
The golden age of television.
Yeah, like that. There was like, you know, those like those kind of TV movie things, like movie of the week things, like were pretty high production quality. So, and this was pretty high production quality, but like I can't determine if it's the source material or the actors that's making it like not that enjoyable to watch.
Listen, Noel Coward's great playwright and his reputation is well deserved. But Ben Hecht adapting Noel Coward for Ernst Lubitsch,
right?
Just layers everything on.
Well, yeah, there's just something just so much. Yeah, really? There's something so much more going on in.
Yeah.
And like the dynamics between the kids, and I think that's, you know, you combine that with Lubitsch's ability to like direct and stuff, like you get this really potent combination of like, holy shit, like there's so much depth to the people, like to this the story. It's worth noting that like everything I've read about Design for Living, the play, is it like there's a reason why it's not one of the ones that's put on very often. It's like not
yeah.
one of the popular ones, and that seems to be a generally rightly deserved.
Pat, before we get into the movie this week, I do want to talk about our Patreon. It's patreon.com/lostincriterion. Over there for $1 a month, you can help keep us going, get access to some bonus content.
Ooh, bonus content.
Let me tell you about it. It's a bonus episode every month. Supporters get to vote on what we're going to watch. I put together a list. Sometimes I let supporters suggest a list. Sometimes, if I'm feeling really, really out there, I'll let Pat suggest a list.
Yeah, I've done it a whole one time.
No, I Pat helps very
it
often.
It makes it sound like you're talking about the way like I talk about when my kid like helps me cook like dinner or something. Like he helped.
Sometimes I let Pat crack an egg when I'm stuck on deciding between a couple of ideas. You are very helpful when I bounce things off of you. Don't downplay your involvement here. And I'm very grateful for your involvement in those situations. But yeah, we have a lot of fun. We do a non-Criterion film. Like I said, it's based on lists I put together that are inspired by really almost anything. Sometimes it's an actor who has recently passed away. We'll do a retrospective of their work. Sometimes it's a director that we watched a movie from in the Criterion Collection who we want to see more stuff from. Sometimes we steal lists from the Criterion Channel when they have an interesting collection of movies up there that isn't otherwise in the Criterion Collection. Yeah, we have a lot of fun. Watch a lot of different movies that maybe won't end up in the Criterion Collection. Sometimes we watch movies that do. We have beat the Criterion Collection on a couple of occasions. I still think Dog Day Afternoon should be in the Criterion Collection.
Every time you tell me it's not, I lose it a little bit because like I can't get over that idea.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's like, does it make sense to me? Like. Yeah, it's wild that was a bonus.
There's,
right.
Yeah, there's two Sidney Lumet movies that we've watched for bonus episodes that both should be in the Criterion Collection, Network and Dog Day Afternoon. And every time I think about either of them, I am, again, confused that they aren't yet. But yeah, in any case, that's all the $1 mark. And that $1 gets you access to all those bonus episodes, all the back catalog bonus episodes. There's 76 over there now. We really appreciate all our $1 supporters. A little above that, folks who can help keep us going a little bit more. $5 supporters, we'd like to thank them on air. Thanks to our current $5 supporters, Andrew Jarrett, Stephen Goldmeyer, Eric Coronado, and Chris Otto. A bit above that, we do something pretty dang special. For our $10 and above mark, Pat makes a piece of art based on one of the movies we watched recently. I get that printed up on a postcard, write a little personalized note, and mail that off to those supporters. And we also like to thank them on air. Thank you so much to our $10 and above supporters, Nina Bojnak, Tracy McGrath, Patrick Yacko, Jason Westhaver, and Adam Spiegerman.
Thank you, everybody.
If you want to see those postcards without committing to that $10 mark, you can head over to redbubble.com, search for Lost in Criterion there, our store will come up. And mostly it exists as a repository for Pat's art, so you can scroll through that, but they are for sale as stickers, as postcards, as greeting cards, as magnets, some as a few other things as well. And we greatly appreciate everyone who has purchased anything off of that.
They are for sale at the lowest possible price we can offer them. The minimum amount of margins.
In the multiple years the Redbubble has been in service, Redbubble has sent me less than $10. So
it is a point of pride that we charge the minimum amount of money that Redbubble will allow us to charge.
Thank you again so much to everybody who's bought anything off that Redbubble, everyone who supported us on Patreon over the years, and thank you for listening. Back to the movie.
What movie? Designed what movie is this? I don't even know.
You know. Yeah, you know, Pat.
I know. Designed for Living. I've mingled the two in my brain, and now it hurts.
Yeah. Designed for Living from 1933, an American comedy directed by Ernst Lubitsch. As I said, adapted to screen by Ben Hecht, based on the 1932 play of the same name by Noel Coward. Also on the DVD, as Pat already mentioned, we have a 1964 British television teleplay version of Designed for Living with an introduction by Noel Coward himself. That edition, obviously, very true to Noel Coward's original
script.
Yeah,
I mean, as far as I can tell, it is verbatim, right? Like, it's exactly just a teleplay, basically.
Yeah. And to hear Coward talk about his script is weird. Because he talks about how essentially he and his buddies wanted to make a play that would get them fired and then waited till they were all powerful enough that it couldn't get them fired to produce it. Produced it, and he seems to hold all of the characters in contempt.
It is strange, right? Because, like, I don't understand what... I, at this point, cannot fully understand what the point he was trying to accomplish was.
Yeah.
Like, I got, and I think a lot of people got out of the movie, right? Because, like, what he gets out of the movie, the play, is the polar opposite, I think, of what literally everyone who enjoys the play gets out of it.
Yes.
Which is this sort of, like, broad-based, like, hey, you know, laissez-faire, like, you know, what you do in your own time, like, the way you want to live your life, as long as it makes you happy and you know, it doesn't hurt anybody. Is fine, right? Like, and like to the point where even our talking head interview basically references that being the way that people understand the movie,
right?
And then the flip side of that becomes that, like, he's like, this would only work for them. Like, this is they're amoral fuck bags and don't deserve your respect or kindness. Who was it? Was it the Talking Head interview who, like, mentioned another story that basically has the same premise?
Joseph McBride is who you're referring to, who has a bonus feature talking about Lubitsch and a bit about the Coward play as well. So Joseph McBride mentions Jules at Gym, which we watched many years ago. It was Spine 271.
Right, I think,
somewhere around there.
That posits that that's impossible, right? Like, Truffaut basically posits that, like, this is an untenable situation.
Yes.
And that, like,
The Truffaut version ends with the woman dead.
Right.
Of heartbreak?
I can't remember
to be
anymore.
Like, kind enough.
I mean, to be fair,
I don't think of suicide, but I don't remember very well.
I don't
well.
Think so either. My memory is real shaky on it, and I honestly don't remember loving Jules and Jim. That was a long time ago, but probably for similar reasons to what we're talking about right now.
Yeah. It is suicide. She kills herself and Jim. She drives him into a river.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Boy, that was a long time ago. I mean, like, either way, you end up in a situation.
It was a long time ago. I had to look up the ending.
Yeah. We end up in a situation where, like, I don't buy into that conceptualization of human relationships. And so,
right,
like,
right.
Regardless of the quality of the movie, and, like, you know, I just don't buy into it, so it doesn't, like, read right to me. But,
and we discussed that at length
back then, when we recorded the episode
as well. Yeah, even back then, neither of us were keen on that interpretation. Listen, you're in a monogamous relationship. I am generally speaking a fan of monogamy in relationships, but polyamory works.
Yeah, I don't buy into the notion of condemning the concept outright as, like, impossible or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and unlike Jules and Jim, unlike the Noel Coward play version of this story, Lubitsch's Design for Living ends with at least the possibility that things are going to work.
Right.
But yeah, Coward's version also is really condescending about... Now all I can think of is Catherine, because Catherine's the character
right.
in Jules and Jim. Really condescending about Gilda. Gilda gets in the Coward play, Gilda gets this "I'm not like other girls" speech that is anti-woman in so
right,
many
right.
ways. and she's barely a character in the play. And she does have a job. She does have her own independent income as an interior designer. So there is that aspect in the play. But Gilda in Lubitsch's film, or Gilda, as they insist on saying it in the Lubitsch film.
Which just it seems like its own funny sort of, like, fuck you to, like, whatever's going on, like, the play. It's like, we're going to say this in the stupidest way possible.
Yes. It's just the gif debate. But
for a person's name, a person with autonomy who can exercise their own pretend,
right.
like, but just like seemingly they do it as I like. One can only assume that like, my forced takeaway is that like it's like a pet name sort of deal where they call her that even though that's 100% not her name. It has.
I have never experienced anyone pronouncing Gilda as Gilda.
That's what I'm saying is it has to be on purpose, like a thing that's like supposed to endear them to you, the audience, about like
Well, they certainly are all endearing.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. So Gilda in the film, and I'm going to say Gilda because I'm not going to remember
because,
to say Gilda.
No, please don't. It hurt every time.
And also it is silly. Gilda in the film, she gets a speech that's much more condemning of status quo. Her speech, instead of being an "I'm not like other girls" sort of thing, is I am in a situation that normally only men are allowed to be in. I have fallen in love with multiple
right,
people.
Right. That was a really fascinating speech for like a movie from the 1930s. But yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Lubitsch obviously has a lot more respect for women than Noel Coward seems to, from this one experience, at least. we will actually be seeing a lot more from Noel Coward pretty soon. We've got a box set of David Lean directing Noel Coward films coming up at Spine number 603. So that's, about 10 weeks away. So, but yeah, we've also already seen David Lean directing Noel Coward with Brief Encounter many, many years ago as well. Like I said, we've seen Noel Coward that we like. Brief Encounter is a brilliant piece of play.
I mean, I don't think the morality of this story is the sole reason why this is not played as often, is all I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Both Coward's play version and Design for the Living were controversial. Lubitsch's Design for the Living were controversial in their time. Lubitsch's version came out. It's technically pre-code. The Production Code Administration really only comes to have its absolute veto power in 1934, the year after this comes out.
Right.
And in fact, this movie was denied re-release certificates moving forward.
I mean, yeah, considering what the requirements are and how they become as time goes on, that makes a lot of sense. Because I've already forgotten the name of the guy, the talking head interview. I cannot keep his name in my head.
McBride.
He mentioned, like, clearly everybody knew what was going on in these stories, but, like, you needed to be able to, like, cut something meaningful, right? And if it's all innuendo and sort of like gestures without showing anything, it's like really hard to cut a thing, right? It's like, yeah. I think the statement was, we know what you're doing, but we can't figure out how you're doing it. which is really fascinating. Right. But like the idea is you're just sort of building up in the audience's mind an understanding of the nature of the world without ever actually saying it out loud, right? And That is really hard to cut, right? Because if you cut it enough to get rid of that implication, there's no movie left. You know, you just don't don't have a film anymore.
The particular scene that plays while McBride is saying that as the example of what he's talking about is the typewriter ding. And like using a typewriter ding as innuendo is itself so like everyone who watches the movie knows what
exactly,
it means.
Exactly, right.
But like you can't in writing put down, you got to cut the typewriter bell and have anyone take you seriously.
Well, and that's where things get more veto power, they don't have to justify themselves, right? Like, they can just be like,
the whole
thing is out. Like, you just can't. And like, you know, that when you think about that, that's kind of so you have film studios preempted that by just not making things they think will get cut, right? The things they think will not pass muster. Because, you know, you don't want to waste the money on production and then discover later that, like, it's not viable. But, like, when you think about it, like, it's kind of every time you encounter things that exist, like, essentially pre-code, it's always the most amazing thing. It's like how interesting the world was before somebody took a hatchet to it. You know what I mean? Like,
think about how interesting this
movie exists. It's so exciting and interesting that it's real and it's like a film that somebody could like watch. And like I find it really fascinating because, like, not to go down like a really intense rabbit hole, but like we talk about, like, we all have a very specific view of like that era of time, right? And like the idea that, like, mm-hmm. we fought the Nazis to fight fascism, and it's like which is true, which is kind of true and accurate, but like at the same time, you're also thinking about, like, well, like, we took a pretty hardcore scalpel to our culture to eliminate anything that we found that was deemed objectionable, right? Like, it's sort of like, it was a very regressive time period when you get into, like, code and stuff like that, Hays Code and stuff like that. It's like, oh, this is all bad. Like, and how interesting things were before they did that.
You know, there's no nudity in this movie, right? There's no... there's only one scene where multiple characters are on a bed together.
Right.
Well, I suppose two, because they do.
Well, I mean, there's scenes, but like they're like so they're so chased, right? They're just like she falls down the bed and they sit on it to talk to her in a very it's extremely chased, right? It's not There's no the scenes where they're in bed together are the scenes that feature the least amount of sexuality of basically the entire film.
When they come to her and her husband's apartment in the third act and are all in her bedroom, it's like teenage girls at a slumber party more than anything, right? You know, and it is a childish love, which on the one hand maybe helps helps Lubitsch get away with it.
Right.
But also it is, I don't know. I feel like it makes the character so much more relatable than Coward's version too. Coward's version seems almost austere in its presentation of people.
Yeah, I also wonder if like you and I are reacting to a certain extent that like we're just not like there's sort of almost, despite the fact that they're supposed to be lowlifes, they come off as being very like, I think Coward describes them as in his mind being like not people who are not economically poor, like economically
right.
disadvantaged, just sort of like playing like low class. You know what I mean? Like
right.
they're like slumming. Yeah, exactly. They're like they're being artists, so they're like living this sort of like what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of like I forget the word I'm looking for, but like they're not actually in that situation if they don't want to be.
They're cosplaying.
Yeah. And like and that comes off in the production that we see, right? That like the way they talk and the way they behave is like basically like people of the sort of at least middle class or upper crust, but they're like just playing poor artists.
Right. They sound middle class, upper crust. Whereas, you know, Cooper and March have pretty middle American accents. You know, they don't even have the you know, there's upper class Hollywood American accents.
Yeah, they're not rocking around talking in like a really refined mid-Atlantic or something like that, right? They're
right, you know, right.
They sound like normal people basically, and they're doing a pretty good job. I mean, they sound like normal people who are artists, but they sound like very believable in that category. You don't look at them and be like, yeah, these people are well-off, rich people who can like do whatever they want. They actually come off maybe a little unbelievable in the other direction, just because you're like, why are these people in Paris? Like, why are these people in London? Like, how did they get there?
Every poor artist could be a poor artist in Paris in 1932. In fact, Paris, even today, I was just reading an article yesterday about how public housing in Paris is still overwhelmingly designed to make sure poor people can still live in Paris and own shops in Paris and have and make art in Paris.
Well, and that's you know, I was just thinking more in the terms of like, how did they get there in the first place, kind of thing. Is more the one sort of thing that becomes kind of a little bit like
right.
Like, because they come off as so normal. It's like, well, like normal people. Right. I don't think normal people were traveling to Paris that much in that era. Like, I mean, maybe they were. I don't know. I don't know what the international like sort of travel situation really, but it seems like that would have been.
Given the number of boats, you could pretty much get on a boat.
Oh yeah, so maybe it was cheap enough that like anybody could be there and like just roam around, which is cool.
As all of the huddled masses were coming to the U.S., there were a lot of empty boats.
A lot of empty boats going back. We'll take whatever we can get on the way back.
Yeah, I really love that they're not very good at what they do. Like,
well, but
it's easier to tell with the paintings than right. the work, the play, because we don't see a full play.
But we do get listen to him struggling to write, figure out what to write in his play, which is funny because you get a lot of like, it's sort of the like stand in some ways it's sort of the standard like frustrated writer artist character like running around like just bemoaning like I can't figure out what to write and like. Something strikes them, like something somebody says, like, oh, that's it. I'm fascinated by it. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that I think the Coward play does more interestingly is that in being already sort of established bohemians, the three of them in Coward's play, and established artists, there's maybe more room for this, but the male characters in Coward's version are much, much more gay-coded than our guys here. We get hints of it in Lubitsch's version, but I think it's much more closer to overt. Obviously, it can't be overt. It wouldn't be overt.
Right. I mean, I would say Coward's version overt. is about as close to overt as you can get at that time period, right? Like it is
right.
Like they're like one step away from making out sometimes. Where you're like, whoa,
right?
Like,
right. And of course, we're seeing a 1964 production. So,
that's also
so
true.
Maybe
that's
those
true,
particular yeah. actors are leaning more into it. But
yeah, if you understand that that's sort of the original intention of the work, then it's like, well, we can do this a little bit more. But like, to be fair, on the flip side, 1960s Britain was also not exactly the most gay friendly place on earth. So
that's also true. That's also true. But, early 60s Britain, not great.
Yeah, and so what I think is the deal is, like, I think we kind of come into a, like, the crux of the difference about what the two artists want to talk about. Like, yeah. I think in many ways, like, Lubitsch is more interested in their relationship with her and, like, mm-hmm. exploring the
and
idea
her
that her relationship,
and her relationship with them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's actually probably, I would say, actually more like what I meant is that, like,
right,
she's a main character in the Lubitsch right. film. Like, she's the crux around which everything turns, and not just in a sort of sexual dynamic, but like in a like social dynamic. Like, without her, they're nothing. Like, they right. essentially are not. We discover they are essentially non-functional without her. Like, you right. know what I mean? Like, without her, they yeah. fall flat immediately. Like, they're not capable. She is everything to them, and in that way, we explore what. She takes focus in that dynamic, and is like
right.
very very important. In the Coward film, like, she's not really that important. She's basically just the topic about which the boys talk,
right?
Then more than anything, and it shows. But like, and then that situation, you kind of end up in a world where it's like, well, in some ways. She becomes a tool in the Coward version, becomes a tool by which Coward can explore their relationship to each other without it. She's essentially like the fig leaf that allows them to be near each yeah. other all the time in some ways. Like,
perhaps.
I don't know. I'm just saying, like, it obviously seems like they're trying to explore different things, like pretty different ideas. Right.
Obviously, in both versions, our male character's relationship conflict is jealousy toward the other's relationship with her. So in both, she exists as that object. In Coward's version, she is basically only that object.
Right. And I would a thing I would argue also is that a big difference between the two versions is that in the Coward version, it's exclusively jealousy, like essentially sexual jealousy. Like, it's just about...
Right.
her as a sexual object, whereas in the Lubitsch version, she's identified as being the like the only reason they're capable of doing the things they're doing, and right, in some ways their right. jealousy extends yeah. beyond a sexual realm into like a social and like personal realm where it's like, I can't be without this person as a person,
right?
So like, you know what I mean? Like that dynamic I think really changes our understanding of her as a character, because she's struggling also with the idea of like determining like, well, which one of these people I enjoy spending time with and for whom I'm important and they're important to me, do I want to spend time with, rather than the Coward version, which is very like just sexual. It's just like,
right.
she slept with him yeah. and now I'm jealous that she slept with him. I want to sleep. But you know, it's like, it's very baseline, like, in some ways, like, obviously the Coward version is really well written, but it doesn't change the fact that it has kind of like sitcom vibes in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that, like, it doesn't really give those relationships any, very much depth.
Right. Particularly Gilda.
Yeah, I mean, well, their relationship with Gilda. Yes, that's what I mean. It's like, because right. what with Gilda basically being the central character of the Lubitsch film, one has to sort of compare to that, right? Like, that's a thing you just have to do, right? You have to, that's like the sort of comparison point of most value.
Right.
Because you're right that Lubitsch's version doesn't have as much of an overt relationship between the two of them, which is unfortunate. But on this, on the flip side, you can still, as an audience, pretty easily read that relationship in there. Like, it's not, doesn't take a rocket scientist to, like, see that, like, well, especially by the end of the movie, they must have come to an agreement where they're all in a relationship together, right? And she's like, they end with, like, the no sex thing, but, like, they also then laugh. So it's like, oh, we're not serious anymore.
Well, like, the Lewitch version ends not necessarily with the no sex thing, but with them reminding each other that it's a gentleman's agreement, which she has already said. I think it's a personal callback, not to the prior gentleman's agreement, but to her, I'm no gentleman.
Right. Either way, I think the audience takes it. I have forgotten exactly how it ends, but the takeaway is like, oh,
yeah,
we're not going to play at this being like...
Right.
Like, we're not going to pretend
anymore.
They've
come to terms with
it. Yeah, like, and I think that's a really, like, yeah. And again, it's all hints and, like, winks and nods, like, as we talked about, like, what do you censor here? I don't know, but, like, the whole audience watches that scene in the cab at the end and is like, oh, they're going to fuck. Like, there's no more, like, pretending that that's not going to happen. And it's a really interesting way to end the movie. And, like, Coward's version just doesn't have the same ring to it that way. Like, you're not really... The Coward's version ends in them all sitting on the couch laughing. He suggests that they're laughing at themselves for their absurdity. I think it's possible that you could read the Coward version as being something similar and saying, like, oh, yeah, like they're going to, like, treat each other as a group. But I don't know that that's necessarily a fair reading of the Coward version.
Right.
But it is definitely a fair reading of the Lubitsch version, like, straight up. Like,
100%.
He definitely intended 100%. That to be the way that ends, so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, Lubitsch also has the benefit of having Miriam Hopkins play Gilda. We've seen her before in our first Lubitsch. She also co-starred in Trouble in Paradise, which, despite being our first Lubitsch and all of Lubitsch being very impressive and great, I will forgive you. It was a very long time ago at Spine 170.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. We see some clips from Trouble in Paradise in one of the other bonus features. So that's scene commentary done by William Paul.
Yeah, I didn't end up watching that one. I just didn't have time.
Except for drawing parallels between Trouble in Paradise and Design for Living, which are films that Lubitsch made back-to-back. There's not a lot of stuff William Paul says that doesn't come up in other stuff. One thing he does point out that I think is very interesting, and is pretty clear in the film, it's sort of anti-commercial art or anti-advertising as art in a lot of ways.
She's even dismissive of the art she does.
Yeah. She's dismissive of the art she does. She gives it up at the drop of a hat to become their manager, which McBride frames as her giving up on her own artistic pursuits. But, and she, I mean, she literally does say her art doesn't matter. But I think it's Lubitsch saying that that type of art doesn't matter more than her particular art doesn't matter. And on top of it, she becomes the manager to these two and is the only reason these two become successful.
Right. You kind of get into this idea of, like, if you think about, like, she takes a sort of role in their work as similar to something like a director or something like Lubitsch himself, in this idea of, like, oh, like, I'm not, like, physically making a thing, but I'm pointing it in the right direction. I'm making it, like, come into life. It's like you kind of in a really weird question of, like, is a muse an artist themselves, right? Like, and she's even more than that, right? Because she's, like, literally managing him and saying, like, that shit, do it
right,
again.
Right,
like,
right.
You're making garbage. Stop. Yeah. Like,
whereas Max Plunkett and the rest of his entourage is a guy who's only interested in prestige and is incredibly banal, right? At least the Max, the character Max began life as in the Coward play, is an art dealer who actually seems kind of interesting as his own person. Max is not interesting, except that he, played by Edward Everett Horton, who's a great character actor, so makes him interesting. But he's meant to be a banal dummy. So, you know.
Right. But I think, and I think that way, like, it you know, because they talk about whether or not it's, like, we call it, like, I never heard the term New York marriage before, but I thought that was an interesting one. But we do clearly see that, like, he's not really interested in her in that way, right? He's not, even in the Lubitsch film, it's just like he allows himself to be distracted by, like, work when they're, like, going to consummate their marriage on their wedding night, right? Like, it's, like, very, like, obviously he's not that into that idea. And, like, he comes off as being, like, just, he seems, like, relatively good-natured, but he's obsessed with his success and his work. And, like, we even kind of, like, give him a happy ending, which is interesting, right? Because he's not the bad guy, right? Like, he's not meant to be a bad guy. He's just not, like,
he's not
who she's, you know, interested in spending time with, right? He's annoying to her in the sense that she doesn't find him interesting and the life he lives interesting. But, like, she's like, well, I'm going to triple your business on my way out. Right. And, like, he seems satisfied with that answer, right? Like,
because
in many ways, her... I would argue that in many ways, her leaving Max is less traumatic than her leaving Ernest.
Yeah.
At the end of the Lubitsch play, despite the fact that Ernest is, in theory, it's literally just a marriage of convenience.
Right.
Like, there's no interest there at all. Like, Ernest is not interested in her sexually at all, as far as this is the notion, right?
I think that's 100% true.
But, like, it hurts his feelings more when she leaves in the Ernest one, or in the coward one,
right,
than it does in the Lubitsch one. The Lubitsch one, they part on good terms.
Yeah. Max,
like, it's in good terms, which is important.
Max is reasonably angry about the embarrassment of this party, but she spins.
But
that.
More specifically, seemingly about the embarrassment of this specific party,
right,
which I think also kind of funny.
Yeah, but she spins that in an advertising sort of way, and sells him on the idea of it, and points out how he can sell his associates on the idea of it and end up getting more work, as you said. Horton, by the way, not only fantastic as Max Plunkett, in a fairly small role, but very good. He's also the narrator in the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. I just want to throw that out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Well,
and then, like, the other thing about their relationship when she leaves is, like, it also, I think, reframes her in an interesting way, which is it reaffirms the idea that, like, oh, she's, like, good as a marketer. Like, she has a very, like, meaningful, real skill, right? Like, she gets, she, in many ways, like, she's not just the power that, like, gives them, their motivation, but she's also, like, the reason they are successful in the
100%
pragmatic way. She markets them. Like, we see her market the play. We see her, like, you come to understand that, like, it's not that she's just a muse. She's, like, fucking putting in real meaningful work that is the reason they are successful and the reason that fucking Max is successful too, right? Like, she doubles his, but she's like, I think the phrase is like, I doubled your business when I came in, I'm going to triple it when I leave. And it's like, damn, she's, like, really good at this. And, like, it's interesting that, like, we constantly put her in positions where we reaffirm, like, how fundamentally important she is to, like, all the people that she's interacting with, which is just so different from the coward story.
Yeah. Yeah, she's...
Like, she doesn't do anything to help Ernest, really, in the coward, like, story.
Right.
Like, she's not actually important to him business-wise.
Yeah, but also in the coward story, both of our artists are already established. Lubitsch...
Right, and I think that's that difference is really important.
Right, Lubitsch has the right instincts to roll us back and show us her building them up as part of their relationship building together. Because it makes the relationship not strictly sexual. Not strictly romantic.
Right.
There's more on the line here. And it makes it more interesting.
Well, yeah. And it really does. It's really worth noting that, like, when we start the coward play, you know, McBride like talks about, like, it's, you know, it's a classic, don't tell, just show, right? But like, I think it goes beyond that. It's just like the Coward version starts in a way where you're like, you also just like don't have a good grasp on like anybody's relationship with anybody, right? But the, you know, in almost the same amount of time, the Lubitsch version builds that relationship in front of you. You come to understand it. You come to understand that, like, she, what her skill set is, what she brings to the to the relationship, and it's, I don't know, it's really, really, I it makes you think like, oh, would the Coward version be better? Obviously, it can't. You know, there's limitations of plays and stuff too, right? That, like, you need to, like, a lot of the stuff that happens in the Lubitsch version wouldn't work in the Coward version,
right?
From pure like pragmatics, but like also it's like, oh man, I really like the Lubitsch version a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly, you know, I mentioned screenwriter Ben Hecht. He wasn't the original choice for screenwriter. Lubitsch wanted his regular guy to do it. Lubitsch's regular guy, Samson Raphaelson, wrote Trouble in Paradise, wrote The Shop Around the Corner, wrote Heaven Can Wait. We've seen two of those in the Criterion Collection, Heaven Can Wait and Trouble in Paradise. Shop Around the Corner is what would be remade as You Got Mail, classic romantic comedy as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Raphaelson apparently just refused to adapt a Coward play that he didn't want to do.
I think that's so
funny. He didn't
want
to
yeah.
do it. I don't have any... I don't have any reasons for that.
Well, I thought, didn't McBride kind of like hint at the idea that like, I'm just not the right man for this kind of like.
Maybe.
This kind of story, basically. I think like the notion was like, because I think McBride mentioned something to the.
He might have.
I mean, he talked about
He definitely mentioned Raphaelson, but yeah.
I think there was a brief like mention of the idea that like, oh, like I'm just not the right man for this. I'm not comfortable
right.
to do this.
So instead he gets Ben Hecht, who is, Hecht has a very long career. Hecht.
Right. Well, I think, like, sorry to interrupt, yeah. but I'm pretty sure in that McBride thing, I think McBride mentioned that, like, Randall Staten, like, recommended.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Oh, if you're going to do a Coward film, there's only one choice right. for this kind of idea, which is really, I think, interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, Hecht gets brought on. And he sort of... Lubitsch's reasoning was that if Coward could write his play, his original play, for three particular actors, why couldn't he rewrite it for... Why couldn't Ben Hecht... Why couldn't someone rewrite it for three other particular actors? So he brought Ben Hecht on to write it for our three people who star. Hecht is interesting. Hecht has a little bit that Lubitsch was a little too touchy-feely for Hecht, we'll put.
Right, yeah. Too involved. Yeah.
Not just too involved, but there is a moment where in describing how our playwright character should interact with people, Lubitsch apparently, I guess really just, it reads like Hecht reacted badly to being repeatedly hugged by Lubitsch, basically.
Oh, really? Yeah. I missed that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it came up in the essay. But yeah, it's just very silly. Said something that if Lubitsch touches me one more time, I'll be a pansy, which kind of just seems like he was maybe in love with Lubitsch, but I don't know. But in any case, Hecht had a very long career. He another thing that comes up in the bonus material is that David O. Selznick realized during production that Gone with the Wind script was terrible. So they hired Ben Hecht to rewrite it in a week. And Ben Hecht...
And then everybody's like, they found out that he hadn't read it, yeah. despite the fact that everybody else in America had
right.
read
most
it.
Most popular novel in the country, Ben Hecht hadn't read it. So they had to explain the story of Ben Hecht. And he's like, okay, sounds weird, but I'll write it. And did. Hecht also wrote what's it, the front page, the movie, and he even actually, I believe, did uncredited rewrites to turn it into His Girl Friday. But yeah, he had a great career too. But obviously, this is neither Heck nor Lubitsch held Noel Coward I'm not going to say they didn't respect him, but they certainly didn't deify him, right? So
no, I think it was like, I think they, like, it comes up in, I think, the bonus material a little bit. It's like the idea that, like, well, if you're going to, like, redo a movie, if you're going to, like, adapt, yeah, you have to, like, I
adapt.
Think Wright talks about, like, just got to tear right. apart, right? Like, it's like, these things are not the same thing. You can't just, like, fuck it. Like, and we see, I think that's part of what we come up with that teleplay thing we got from the BBC is part of it is not just that, like, I mentioned, like, I don't know if it's the source material or the actors, but some of it I think might just come down to, like, plays make bad movies.
Yeah.
Like, if left unaltered, like, unless you, it becomes a whole different animal when you do the thing that, like, you know, we encounter with Bergman and stuff where you're like, okay, I'm going to show the stage. I'm going to, like, engage with the idea that you are watching a play on TV. That's a different thing because you then, as an audience member, engage with it as a mm-hmm. play, which sets your mind in a different place. But when you just take a play, the script from a play, and just, like, fucking put it on the screen, it's somehow, like, they're just not the same thing. Like, audience has different expectations. The stylings are different. What you're expected to say versus show, as we saw with this movie, are different. Yeah. And, like, I think that some of what we encountered with the play is, like, the BBC thing was just the fact that, like, oh, like, you're just showing me a play.
Right.
Like, and that doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, I don't know. We've already said it. I just feel like the characters are more round in Lubitsch's version, too. You know.
Right. I generally agree with that. I do think that the other things we have said are true. I was just also thinking, like, I wonder if some of that roundness comes from the fact that, like, plays sort of engage with the idea that you as the audience member are present and therefore form an affection that, like, you get from being in person with another person in a way that the screen sort of reduces.
Yeah, I don't know.
And so I wonder if, like, it's just a sort of mental curiosity of, like, I wonder if these characters are more endearing when you're in person in a play, like, in a theater with them.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's true. It's just an idea to explain away the fact that, like, well, Noel Coward is a well-respected playwright. It would be strange for him to have one that is just, I really did not enjoy the BBC one at all.
Yeah. Like, it is ITV.
And so some of it, I wonder if, like, oh, sorry. Well, I mean, I'm just, I'm thinking,
it is British television.
It's on British television. Yeah. Like, my point just being that, like, the British television one, some of it might be the actors not pulling off the characters very well. Yeah. And so, like, they're not endearing partially because they're not being well played. But I don't know. I'm just trying to think of, like, basically excuses.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, like, I don't want to believe that, like, this play is just kind of bad.
Yeah.
Like, on a core level, which is kind of where I mentally ended up with it when I was
done. I think,
I was like, well, that wasn't fun for me. I did not enjoy it.
As we've already covered, there are a lot of ways where this play is just kind of bad at a fundamental level.
Yeah. And it's possible.
It's,
I was trying to see if I could come up with an excuse for why it's, like, maybe not as bad as we think it is. I can't come up with anything, really. It's also, we started with the better version, right? Like, we basically started with the better version of this story. But then again, like, people, like, did not like the fact that this movie was not.
Oh, people love, people loved Coward.
People wanted what they got on the British ITV version, which is crazy to me because it's not good, right? Like, it's just not, it's not good.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's
like, watch, go ahead. Sorry.
I don't even know that, like, Coward's right to complain that this is an adaptation in name only, You know, he says there's maybe three lines I wrote in their script. I don't think order would have mattered. If we had watched the play version first and then got.
No, I think you're probably right. But like, I think in some ways, right. I more order in production in the sense that like the Lubitsch has the ability to say like it, to kind of view the play in hindsight and go, well, these are the things that I don't think are good in this. But, the other side about that is like, you know, the idea that this is an adaptation in name only is an interesting idea because it is more true than normal, I would say.
Yeah.
In the sense that like the sentiments are not the same, which is a big difference. Like a lot of times you talk about like people talk about adapting works and you're like, well, the goal was to maintain the like core concepts and the sentiments of the story, but like to adapt it to the screen, we had to do some major changes to make it work. This is beyond that. The sentiments are not the same.
Yeah.
Like Lubitsch is saying very different things than what
Lubitsch is taking the relationship structure, the love triangle that has another line off to one side, the love lollipop, I guess. And building a fundamentally, I mean, not one's still a playwright, one's still an artist.
But those are essentially superficial connections in a lot of ways, right? Like you could even like it's more just because we want them to be artists. We don't, and you're like, well, what kind of artists exist is almost sort of the question,
right? Right. Yeah.
One of them could have been a musician. It would have been fine. Like the guy. The playwright could have been a musician.
Right.
Wouldn't have changed on the core level anything.
Well, I think one thing it would have changed is that a bad musician can get drummed out pretty quick, whereas a bad playwright with good marketing, selling one play, and a bad artist.
I guess that's true.
Falling into, again, with good marketing, good word of mouth, falling into doing portraits of rich people who he doesn't care for
would argue that I think you're basically right. I would say that like we've seen that the opposite can be very
true.
This world with regards to art, like music is an art form. Like if the marketing's good enough, it'll get played and it'll just sort of worm its way into your brain.
Yeah,
kind of.
The
reason I just say that is that I would say that music and art and like physical art, like painting, are very similar in that capacity.
Yeah.
That, like you can tell the world that this is not shit.
Right.
And there's a thing that has happened many times in this world.
Right. And this movie does not want to tell
I think plays are the big thing. No.
I think the difference
the plays are is that plays have such a weird lead up time to them that like how many plays does a bad playwright get to write and put on?
Right.
The answer is like one.
Right. And we see him do one, but it's actually very well received, and he makes a lot of money off of it.
Right, and it's and how much of that's marketing, and how much I mean, like the people are laughing quite hard, right? And so, it is no more or worse received than the art or the music would be in the situation of being like, well, I mean, people seem to be enjoying it. Like, is that because they were told to enjoy it? I don't know, but the point is, like, they're laughing.
Right. He doesn't get fired immediately. It's true. Yeah. I love how everyone's introduced. My first note for this movie is that these two guys are way, way, way too interested in seeing naked Napoleon fan art.
See, that's why I think, like, I think to a certain extent, Lubitsch is just more subtle.
Yeah.
But some of the things are still there, right? Like, they're both really titillated by, like, Napoleon
disrobing
in his underwear.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, really exciting for them. Yeah. And, like, and maybe it's just in a comedic way, but, like, it's not like Napoleon's a going concern. It's not like it's naked fan art of, like, a guy who's still alive.
Tom licks his lips before he turns the final page.
Yeah. Like, you know, but you know what I mean, right? Like, it'd be one thing... There's like a different sort of titillation if it were like a like the current president of France or something like that. And you're like, oh, well, this is salacious. Yeah. And I want to see more because it is by the nature of it being salacious. Well, like this is a historical.
It's a silly little cartoon image of a historical figure.
Right, exactly. And so, like being like somewhat excited by it is purely a like personal thing, and not like a like social construct at that point. Right. You know what I mean? Like it's like, ooh, we're getting won over on this on this jerk that we all know. It's like, no, this is a dead guy, and these are cartoons. We have our first like hentai pervert is what I'm saying.
Well, not the first.
Like a pair, two of them. Oh, of course not the actual first, but the first one's featured on film. I'm gonna say like it's very silly, but it's also like it's interesting how they establish her as an artist because like her doodles are like they're like cartoons. Her cartoons are good,
right?
But they are stupid. Right. She doesn't have a lot of respect for them because she doesn't feel like they are really hard. But we do come to understand very quickly that she is, from her drawing of them, that especially, that she is an artist. She is good at the things she is giving them advice about as well. Like, she has... Lubitsch does such a good job of so very, very, very quickly, and at that time, with no dialogue... establishing her credentials to prove to the audience that like she's not the character from the Coward film,
right?
From the Coward play, that she has the credentials to be what she is to them. That like it's not just a like air quotes muse sort of thing, right? It is a when she gives advice about what's good or bad, she knows what she's talking about, which is interesting.
And when Tom replies that she's just not smart enough, he's wrong, and the movie knows he's wrong and wants the audience to know
he's wrong. We as the audience know she's wrong. It knows he's wrong. Like we're like, you're being petty because it hurts your feelings. You're not right.
Like you said, she has that same ability with the marketing stuff. I think it wouldn't have been McBride. It had to have been the scene commentary. That's the other bonus feature that you didn't watch, with William Paul.
Yeah.
But Paul points out very interesting that our first scene back in New York, Gilda is not only she's no longer doing marketing. She has become the marketed. She's in a shop window when we see her in New York for the first time. And she's just meant to be Max's good luck charm or whatever, you know. He doesn't want her to function in her job anymore.
Well, right. I mean, she's put in a place, a sort of more traditional feminine place, right? Of like the ad executive's wife who entertains the guests, right? She's, which is a kind of marketing, but it's like a much sort of like
unpaid kind of marketing.
It certainly does represent it does also represent a skill, right? Entertaining guests is absolutely a personal social skill that requires lots of work, right? Like she's still doing to the point where it exhausts her because she finds it boring and hates it, but it's still a lot of work, right? And like, but it's more of a jewel in his crown than it is like her, right? Like it's no longer, she's not marketing by being herself. She's marketing by being his wife, which is not anything she wants, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's, you know.
And we come to understand that she enters into that relationship as a way to run away from her problems with them, right? Like she's not in that relationship because she finds him fun, engaging, or interesting. So,
And you know, it's Max does want her sexually, unlike the Coward play implies more.
Well, I'm torn on that. He does like kick the. I don't know. I'm torn on the whole thing because it's hard to tell in the movie. I think you're right, but at the same time, like, their relationship in the movie is complicated and confusing because he allows himself to be distracted from that really easily. Yeah. So it's sort of like, I don't know. So you kind of like, I think understanding Max is something that's supposed to be hard for us to do as an audience. I think we're supposed to look at Max and not fully grasp, like, his sexuality is supposed to be confusing and, like,
maybe
hard to, or even, I mean, just like in the sense that we're not, I don't think, supposed to think about it.
Yeah. Too. I think,
I don't think we're supposed to waste mental energy on figuring out, like, how into Gilda
Max
he is.
Max is a guy who has been friend zoned long before that was a thing that
right.
anyone talked about. And now we're past that being a thing that anyone talks about as a concept, because it's inherently a pretty misogynistic concept too. But yeah, he's, you know, he's got no chance with Gilda and she's not interested in him. And then the stuff with the tulips is them not consummating their marriage. Right.
Right.
But, you know, it's not necessarily just that the tulip showed up, you know. She might have done it, who knows, but she's not interested in doing it as a core to her personality, I think, prior to that.
Right, and that's the thing is that you end up in a really complicated place because she clearly is not interested in him in
right.
that way. He is, but, like, he doesn't seem to be... We don't see him pushing it in
right.
any way, like, as a part of the story. After, like, he... Like, even when they are... In the preamble, where he is kind of trying to, like, deal with them,
right?
Like, remember, like, early on,
yeah, where he's trying to scare
Tom,
and where he's trying to scare him off.
He doesn't appear to be trying to scare them away because he wants her exactly as much as he's, like, quote unquote, sort of protecting her honor. Kind
yeah,
of thing. And I think what I mean is, like, I think that in many ways, Max got what he wanted.
Right.
Which is Gilda as a,
I think,
tool to use in marketing his business.
I think Gilda's last conversation with Max is accurate to what Max actually wanted. I do think that for expectations
Max
of the audience,
to marry her
expectations
then, but,
of what
yeah.
What would have been expected of Max in a real life situation here, Max did desire a sexual aspect to this relationship, but she is accurate to say what Max truly wanted was her as a means of increasing his publicity. And he got that, right? And as she points out, her leaving
right.
gets him that even more. Because now he can appear to be the bigger man, and relate even better to the concrete kings of New York or whatever those guys are meant to be.
Yeah, I love it. Like, the people that he's, like, like, I love that, like, the choices made in terms of, like, between Hecht and, like, Lubitsch, like, the choices made with regards to, like, who is, like, the way they talk about the people, like...
Yeah.
Max is doing marketing for the concrete kings of New York.
Yeah.
Right? But, like, just the most boring-sounding human
yeah.
beings on
yeah.
earth. They're, like, talking about concrete. He says the word concrete, like, 1,000
yeah.
times. And, like, and you as an audience the whole time are just getting more and more like, I want to leave too,
yes,
okay?
Yes,
like,
yes.
Me and you, Gilda, want to get out of here, okay? I'm tired of hearing about concrete.
At least the underwear guys are inherently interesting. And also
right.
apparently fighting. Oh, no, that was the concrete guys were fighting too. But, yeah.
No, the concrete guys don't get along.
Right.
They've had, like, some sort of split. The underwear thing is, like, was more that, like, apparently
the French,
I think
the
that's
French
so
government
funny.
Shut
like,
down
the whole, like, the French shut down the guy, it got censored.
Yeah.
It's so
yeah.
funny.
No, it's very good. Yeah, there's a lot of.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
There's a lot. There's so many good jokes in this movie.
It's really. Yeah. it is fantastic.
Like, we changed the Caesar and it was fine. It's like, that's just.
Because, of course, the French don't care.
So funny.
French don't care about Caesar. Also, This was a really interesting thing, and I don't know. I presume it was on purpose, because we have seen Lubitsch be more interested in quality. The scene of Paris outside their apartment, the Eiffel Tower is slightly crooked. It like bends toward the top.
Is it?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was something in the transfer. I don't know if it's original but yeah, it sort of has a little crook at the toward the top. Or at least I noticed it in one scene. I don't know. I didn't go back and double check, but yeah.
That's interesting.
But those two guys, I love when she first comes to their apartment and she's being sort of seductive and talking about how she loves both of them. But then every time she throws herself onto the bed, just this puff of dust pops up.
The puff of glass. My favorite, actually, like, I love the dust cloud, but yeah. I love when he slides the chair. There's just a pile of shit under the chair. Yes. That's the one that got me. It was so funny. I was like, oh, my God.
That just this, you know, the showing and not telling of just this implication that they cleaned up like two bachelors would have cleaned up. They shoved everything.
Right, they kicked a bunch of shit underneath the chair and stuff, and then they forgot and then moved the chair. Yeah, yes. It's so good.
Yeah, it's a very funny movie.
Yeah, it's hilarious, actually.
Every Lubitsch we've seen so far has been just a great funny movie.
He's good at it. Like, he's just really, really good at it.
Yeah.
One of the reasons they turn out so good in some ways is that this sort of earnest engagement with the character, like earnest like treatment of the characters, like you feel a lot of connection to like all three of them, right? Like you like, even like when they're kind of being shitty to each other a little bit, like you like them, right? Like you form a really affectionate, like the comedy doesn't come from meanness, right? It's not derived from cruelty to these people. He's not saying negative things about them for being poor bachelors, right? Like, he's not treating them badly for it. Instead, you see yourself in it, and you're like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. I remember when there were socks under my chair. You know what I mean? Like, we've been there. And I think that's an interesting thing, because it makes the comedy more it just makes it more enjoyable. It just makes it more, like, you as the audience don't have to feel bad when you laugh, because even as we talked about, even with Max, you're not really laughing at Max. Like, Max is not the butt of a joke. He is just a guy who has different. Can be a butt of a joke.
Yeah, with the exception of that thing he tells both of them that ends up in the play.
But the thing about it is think about it this way though. The thing he says gets a lot of laughs, and it's not laughed. It's a funny thing he said, but like it's like, I don't know how to explain it. Like, I don't even think you're meant to read it as like, isn't this a stupid thing to say? Like, it's more that like it he's just like operating in a totally different like
realm
space. And so like, and the thing about it is like in the play that it gets put in, it's the same basic idea, right? It's like, oh, like here's a guy who sees the world completely different than the people he's talking to the point where that juxtaposition is hilarious, right? And it is in the story too, when he says it, is just saying it to the people he's saying it, it's a meaningless statement because they don't see the world that way. The whole thing is just really, I mean, like, I think the movie has a lot of sympathy even for Max as a person. Like, it's like, it doesn't treat him like he's, because in a lot of movies, right, he would be the bad guy who's trying to like break them up. And that's just not the position he's playing, right? The thing that breaks them up over and over and again is like them coming to terms with the situation they're in. There's no outside force trying to tear them apart. Other than, I guess, society as a whole, right?
Yeah.
Which does not necessarily condone their behavior.
Right. But as Gilda points out, her behavior particularly would be condemned.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, it's also the idea that like, it's not even like, there's not a, the society isn't even manifest. It isn't even physical. It's not represented by a person. It is just there. It's internalized to them. Right. And they're getting over the ideas that they're like the cultural things that they have inside of them that are stopping them from like just engaging with this completely, like committing to the whole relationship completely, is a thing internal to them. There's nobody going, like, there's, other than Max that one time,
yeah,
we don't get anybody going, like, tutting them about their behavior, right? Like, that's, and I think in some ways that's Lubitsch, and Coward too, in his version. But again, we kind of get mixed messages from Coward as an artist here about that. But like, especially with Lubitsch, that internal difficulty they're having reflects the internal difficulty that the audience is having with this relationship. And like, so Lubitsch is kind of tutting you as the audience for like thinking this is strange or bad or not good, right? And that, because you are reflective of that societal norm that they have inside of them that's saying, no, she has to pick.
Right.
Like they have to come to terms where one is the answer. Like, and like, you know, it's sort of in that way, he's talking to you, us as the audience,
right,
not through their yeah, problems, their difficulties with accepting it. And they do accept it at the end, which is like, well, is a sort of like, hey, hopefully by now you as an audience member have come to terms with this,
yeah,
and understand that like this is fine.
And her speech is even broader than that, right? Her speech is that she should be allowed to try on 100 hats, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They are representative of some percentage, not the entirety, right? Like it's like, oh well, now I just need to pick two instead of
right,
one. Well, that's the same thing. That's the same problem.
Yeah, yeah. She tries on two hats, and then the third hat makes an honest woman out of her. And I think her reaction every time is so great when Max tells her that he forgives her, and she's like, "What are you talking about? You forgive me?"
yeah. Well, see, and that's the thing, is like that's the one dig at Max is the fact that he has not
right,
gotten over
absolutely not
his problem with that idea. And so in many ways he represents the audience in that capacity of like, are you still bothered by this? Because like, you're not supposed to be, like, this is not your none of your business or your problem here, other than just as an audience member, just to sit back and enjoy it.
Yeah. And it's a great movie to sit back and enjoy.
I laughed really hard. There were like multiple scenes that just really tore me up. I thought this was just so funny. It makes me wish. I know we have more Lubitsch in the collection,
yeah,
but it's one of those cases where like we this happens sometimes with these movies where it's like, could we just like watch them all now? Could you not make me wait? Like, because the last Lubitsch was what, like 400 episodes ago?
Well, Heaven Can Wait.
Right?
We did do Heaven Can Wait, which was 291. So that's 300 episodes ago. Yeah.
Yeah, either way, could you pick up the pace,
right,
is what
right,
I'm saying. Like, I would like to watch more. And I, you know, this is a me problem, not
yeah,
an actual problem of like, I don't really love running ahead. It makes me feel bad for
right,
some reason.
Right, right. Yeah. Our next one's his version of To Be or Not to Be, and that's 2 years away. So,
yeah, that's just such a long
We might have to do, there's four.
Are there some ones that are not in the
collection? There's
four
Lubitsch
that
are in the Eclipse, but not the actual Criterion Collection. And they they are all also pre-code comments.
Oh, that sounds so
good.
We
might have to do that for a list.
Yeah, I can't find a reason
yeah,
not to.
We'll see how that shakes out in April. But yeah. Yeah, he's really great. Heaven Can Wait was the other one where that's where the guy dies and goes to hell and tries to tell the devil about why he should be in hell. Because he was a womanizing jerk. Also very funny, and one of my favorite I think the bonus episode based on Heaven Can Wait was on comedic devils in film, but Heaven Can Wait is one of my favorite film Satans. He just keeps walking down the stairs. It's just this huge stairwell into
Right.
A negative high rise, basically. Speaking of which, actually, we do have one other thing on the bonus materials. Did you get a chance to watch the short that was included on this called The Clerk?
Yeah, I did. That was fun. Yeah. I really liked that. Like, so it's like part of an omnibus.
Yeah.
I'm curious what the rest of the omnibus was like. I really liked it. The anticipation, the build-up anticipation was so good. Like, it's really interesting to see that, like, and so that's Lubitsch as well,
yes.
right? Like, Lubitsch just did, like, 2 minutes of this omnibus thing. And I find that really fascinating because, like, it goes to show you that, like, we've mostly engaged with Lubitsch in these, like, long form. A lot of the jokes have fairly long build-ups that, like, are kind of, like, building on each other. We're like, okay, well, we're going to call back to a thing that happened earlier in the story, and this will be even more funny because we're doing it again, but, like, now the context has changed a little bit. And I Lubitsch's comedy, like, I kind of have understood it as very long form in that way, right? Like, there's good jokes, but there's also, like, they build on each other. Whereas this one, like, 2 minutes of, like, really beautifully compact comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it's so good. Like, as you see where, like, the audience goes through the entire, like, this entire, like, arc.
Yeah.
As an audience member in 2 minutes, right? Like, you see the number, and you're like, okay. And you're like, well, that's a lot of money. Like, that's a lot of money. This is what's going on, right? And then you see him, like, get up and start to walk out, and he's climbing the stairs, and, like, you're going through the bus, like, you're in your head, you're like, is he going to, like, tell somebody they gave him too much money? Yeah. Or is he going to, like, you kind of, well, maybe he'll quit, but that's not really, like, my main thought is, like, considering how buttoned up he is, you're like, oh, I think this guy's going to go to, like, the accounting department
right.
and tell them, hey, you guys gave me too much money or something like that, right? Is my thought process on it. And then you get, like, as you pass through all those doors, which is also its own great comedic bit, right? Like, this
building anticipation, like building anticipation, building anticipation.
And just, like, the idea that this guy has a secretary for his secretary is just its own sort of special. But who don't feature, right? Like, there's a bunch of doors, but they're
no
meaningless
people.
Because nobody's there. And then you finally go in, and you're like, oh, like, he's going to go see the president. Yeah. Like, this is... And then he adjusts his tie right before, which is only funny in hindsight.
Right.
Like, it's only a funny joke after the whole thing's over. You're like, what? Oh, he, like, yeah, it's just, oh, man, it's so fucking good. That for only being 2 minutes long, it is. And then, like, when you finally find out what he's going to do, it's about the funniest possible thing that he could do. It's like. The best thing that could happen.
Just blows the raspberry.
It just leaves. It's so good. I love it. Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah. It's the omnibus is called If I Had a Million. It came out in 1932.
Okay.
Charles Laughton plays our main character in this one. And Laughton, we saw Laughton fairly recently, actually.
Yeah, I mean, Laughton is somebody.
But we've seen Laughton a lot, yeah.
Multiple times?
And obviously, he directed Night of the Hunter, but we saw him acting in something fairly recently. I can't remember what it was. It wasn't 12 Angry Men just last week, was it? I can't remember.
Don't ask me those kind of questions.
I'm sorry. I should never. But yeah, we've seen him a bunch. And he's great here. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 sections to If I Had a Million. And the whole thing's 88 minutes
long. That would be fun to watch.
So it does seem like this one's probably the shortest of the set as well.
Right. If it's 88 and you said eight sections, so, like, everybody else had something to the tune of like 11 to 10 minutes. And he took two. Well, hey. If you can do the joke in two, why make it longer? In fact, you're just going to ruin it by stretching it out.
The concept of If I Had a Million is that a dying industrial tycoon named John Glidden, played by Richard Bennett, has decided to just give a whole bunch of random people $1 million so that... he picks them at random from the telephone book before he dies.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. though in a meta joke in the framing element, apparently the first name he picks from the phone book is John D. Rockefeller, and he decides maybe Rockefeller doesn't need $1 million.
Maybe I don't need to do that. That's pretty good.
But yeah. So it's the eight different people he gives the $1 million to, and this is just one of the stories.
That's a really fascinating premise. This sounds like it would be a lot of fun to watch. Like, we couldn't build a whole list around it because we would obviously just want to watch
it. Right, right. And we've already seen the Lubitsch section of it. But
that does sound really fascinating in and of itself.
In any case, the clerk section is hilarious. I don't know if the rest are played for humor or drama or what. It seems like it's a premise that you could take a lot of different ways depending on who gets.
Oh yeah, you could absolutely make it a drama, right? And you know, and not all of them have to be positive, right? Like, you know, it could be positive or negative, right? But it was a lot of fun. I really, really, I did not expect to just have like this 2 minute. I kind of assumed that it was gonna, well, because like, you know, like usually when something's like 2 minute in our bonus materials, it usually means it's like it's a lost piece of something, or like it's just like a kind of like meant for like more just sort of edification about like style or something. Right. And to have it just be a 2 minute joke is
you said, perfect. Even with the other Lubitsch stuff we've seen, knowing Lubitsch's style, his humor, that is not what I was expecting at all.
Exactly. Like I was because like he very funny, but like not a one gag guy.
Right. You know what I mean? It was so good. A really great short paired with a really great movie. So thank you, Kreisinger, for doing that.
I thought this is every so often Criterion really hits it out of the park, and this is one of them. I even actually appreciated, despite the fact that I didn't really enjoy it, I appreciated having the teleplay version of it to like actually see what the Coward play was, which doesn't usually happen. Right. Like usually when we encounter adaptations and stuff, if we wanted to watch the original, we would have to go seek it out ourselves. Right. It would be a whole different thing, and we probably wouldn't do it because we wouldn't have time. I was excited to do it because I was like, well, for once, I can be reasonably informed about like the differences between the original work and the adaptation.
We will never read the novel, but we might watch the play.
Well, exactly. I can give away an hour or two. Yeah. I can't read a book. Forget it, man. Like, that's not going to happen.
And we got to hear Noel Coward not understand his own work, which is always fun.
Yeah, seemingly trying to lie about his own play.
Yeah.
Honestly, I kind of wonder if he just decided, like, I don't know, man, because like that's like just not a reasonable reading of his own play.
Yeah.
Like it's almost as though he's just fucking with the British audience.
Maybe it's possible. Maybe Coward knows.
Well, but bear in mind, as we talked about, the '60s is still not an amazing time. If he's like, what we're dealing with is a classic sort of case of like, he still can't actively talk about what the play is actually about.
Right.
In a lot of ways, right? Like he's still not allowed to talk about that on TV.
Yeah, it's possible.
And so it could be played because it's all innuendo and nothing's written down, but you still can't just go on TV and be like, these two men love each other.
It's possible that even in 64, Coward might have felt that he would have to have downplayed that particularly in his commentary about the film. Yeah, that's true. Maybe we should.
Because we've encountered, we don't know that that's the case, but like we've encountered artists having to do that before. This wouldn't be the first time of like, where like they just can't tell you because like if I were to tell you, it would never be played ever again.
I do.
If I were to say the words, it would never ever, no one ever would get to see it again.
I also appreciate the McBride, the bonus feature with Joseph McBride, because he also references what we saw Coward say. He references that Coward introduction to the play. And in doing so, brings up a D.H. Lawrence quote that I wasn't familiar with. But apparently D.H. Lawrence said, "Never trust the teller, trust the tale," which is a great way of saying what we often use Death of the Author as a shorthand for. What the creator says the work is about isn't necessarily what the work is about. What the work
Right, and especially...
What the work is about is what the work is about. And, yeah.
Right, yeah. Well, and especially if you consider, like, when you're talking about really difficult or complicated, like, subjects that are difficult to talk about in public, which like, homosexuality in the 1960s would be,
right.
Like, especially in Britain, like, everywhere, but, like, especially in Britain, like, I mean, when did homosexuality become legal?
Oh, man.
Like, just the act of being a homosexual, like, was, I mean, Turing was
67.
Chemically castrated, so, I mean, so it wasn't even legal when it was on TV, is what I'm saying. Like,
3 years later.
He couldn't just go on TV and say, hey, these two dudes love each other. Yeah. Like, that's illegal. So he's certainly not going to, and so if you think about things in that context, right, that idea of, like, trust the tale, not the teller, becomes even more prescient because it's like, well, he literally can't say one of the core components. He literally is not legally allowed to talk about one of the core components of the story.
Right, right.
The audience can watch the story, obviously determine that that's the case, but he can't say it.
Right.
And if you can't say the one of the cruxes of the story, like, what fucking can you say?
Yeah.
He can't go on the screen and be like, hey, just watch the movie, fucking figure it out, wink, wink, and then, like, hang up. He has to, like, say something.
Yeah. And the closest the Coward Play gets to a sort of Lubitsch-style innuendo, even, is when one of Friedman's friends, when our two main characters walk in, and she says, oh, Paris. Paris used to be so much more gay, or something to that extent.
Right.
And we get it.
Well, there's a couple times, like, there's a couple times when they, like, I feel like there's a couple times in the Coward film, right, where, like, or the Coward thing, where, like, and obviously the actors know
what this movie
is about as well, right? And, like, there's a couple times I've forgotten their names now. I've lost track of the main characters.
Well, in the
Otto
and Leo in the play.
They're not the same name, right?
They are.
Yeah, Otto and Leo. Yeah, where Otto and Leo, there's a couple of times where they lean over and their faces get
close.
You're like, and you're like, oh man, like everybody knows, like the people making the play, like the actors know, the audience knows, but we can't just go on TV and say. Which is, I don't know, that's a whole other sort of dynamic that's interesting to examine that we don't really have time to dig into too far, but,
yeah. Yeah, and again, I think that is a spot where the play version is stronger than Lubitsch's version. I think...
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree, yeah.
I think there is a level of male intimacy that Tom and George portray that is... deeper than you could get away with in American film for a very long time. But there's still a line they don't even begin to approach that Coward does cross.
Right.
So, yeah. And I wish that it had approached it more. Because
well, I think it's kind of interesting. Like, I think as an audience member, we're still...
Right.
In the Lubitsch version, like, if we're as an audience going to imagine, like, well, okay, well, this relationship has a different dynamic now, especially by the end. Like, there must be something there because that's the only way this is going to work, right? Like, we can, as an audience, sort of, like, do the math, but it's not the same. And I wish it, I agree, I wish it were more. I think if you could combine that element of the Coward film with the Lubitsch film, you would have
not for nothing though. Do we see a second bed in Tom and George's apartment?
No, we do not.
So maybe there is that.
Well, I think the Lubitsch film does toy with the idea that, like, at the very least, these are air quotes confirmed bachelors.
Yes, yes.
You know what I mean? Like, I think you as an audience are supposed to read them as. If not sexually like entangled, at least being like really far more intimate than like your what the audience would consider the average male roommates.
They they fall asleep against one another in the train. But again, you know, there's a level of male intimacy to their relationship that is not necessarily abnormal. Like, we had those two comic relief characters in they show up in a bunch of stuff, but they were originally in The Lady Vanishes. And those guys, those guys share a bed, right? And it's not, you know, they're not implied to be homosexual for sharing that bed. They're just the comic relief guys. It's funny that they share a bed, but it's not gay that they share
a
bed.
I mean, the big difference here being that these are the, main characters of our movie. So that's a, that makes it a little bit more intense, right? Like, we're supposed to spend a little more time thinking about them as people.
Right, very much so. But yeah, so, you know, they're, it does exist. Lubitsch is great at innuendo, right?
We just wish it were more, right? Like, we just, it would have been great to see more of the that element of the coward film or a coward story.
Because
in this,
in Cowards, it's heavily implied to be a true triangle, whereas here it is still a V.
Right.
As far as,
well, on the flip side, the coward version, her place in that V, in that triangle, is so supplanted in many ways that it is almost a V in the, if you could imagine two V's where the triangle point doesn't, I don't know, like, it's hard to explain, but like, it's like,
yes, the love triangle in the coward
triangle
version,
the one point of the,
it's non-Euclidean.
It's more like a, it's, yeah, it is in a lot of ways, because it's like, it's so much about them and their relationship that it sort of doesn't bother to really think that hard about their relationship with Gilda in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So.
But yeah. Without gushing more about what I found funny in this movie, I don't know that I have a lot more to say. It's a really great movie, and I loved it.
Oh, yeah, the classic problem.
I
like, shit, now we're just going to talk about the funny stuff.
I don't want to imply that I did not absolutely love the last four films we've watched, but the Three Colors trilogy and 12 Angry Men were heavy movies, and I am very grateful for the Criterion Collection to follow that up with a Lubitsch film for us. Lubitsch is always welcome.
Yeah, it is a very nice refresher, right? Yeah, very, very,
yeah,
palate cleanser in a lot of ways.
So, very relieving, and yeah, always fun to see a Lubitsch. What would Lubitsch do? That was Billy Wilder, I think, was the story. Billy Wilder had "What Would Lubitsch Do" written on his wall in his writing office,
right?
But yeah, so let's pull this to a close. We've been talking about 1933's Design for Living, directed by Ernst Lubitsch, adapted by Ben Hecht from the play of the same name by Noel Coward. On the bonus materials, we also get a ITV 1964 television adaptation of that Noel Coward play with Coward introducing it. I don't think Coward directed that version. I don't know who directed that version. I don't have any credits for that version except what are in the file. So I'd have to go back and watch the closing credits to figure it out. But I'm pretty sure Coward did not direct it. Coward was a screenwriter anyway. I don't know they directed much of his own stuff at all. Or he was a playwright, principally. I don't think he directed much of his own stuff. But yeah. Design for Living. Fantastic film. Next week, we'll be talking about... We're following up a Lubitsch with a Buñuel. And how great is that? We haven't watched a Buñuel for a really long time either. So Louis Buñuel's Belle de Jour we'll have for next week from 1967. And definitely look forward to that as well, because we love a we love a Buñuel.
Yeah, we even, do. I'm pretty excited.
Even a Buñuel whose cover declares it Louis Buñuel's masterpiece of erotica. It's still Louis Buñuel. So,
right.
And to be perfectly honest, Buñuel embracing erotica is always going to be funny to me.
I'm fascinated because Buñuel's sort of general attitude towards the world seems like, I can't imagine what his air quotes embracing of erotica would even look like. I have no conception of what this is going to be.
The guy who thought foot fetishes were inherently funny, which I agree with him on,
Well, but then, like, a guy who, like, just thinking about Brunel is like, I mean, like, if you think about, like, what stage of Brunel, who knows,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, I mean, thinking about the movies he made, it's like, this could be literally anything.
Adam. Yeah. It's 67, so it's just before Discreet Charm and Obscure Object and all of that, and well after Exterminating Angel. So, yeah, it's, who knows what we'll get. But I definitely look forward to it.
Yeah, like trying to extrapolate from something like Exterminating Angel into embracing erotica. Yeah. I don't even know.
Right.
I don't.
Right. But in any case, look forward to it. Thank you so much for listening to Lost in Criterion. I'm as always Liam Glass. With me as always, John Patrick over Tari Dorgan. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Lost in Criterion with co-hosts The Adam Glass and John Patrick Owatari Dorgan. With the collapse of Twitter, who knows what social media we might end up at. How about Blue Sky? That sounds great. Check out the official podcast account at lostincriterion.bsky.social. Jonathan Hape does our music, and you can check out more of his work at jonathan-hape.com or on any music streaming service. And you probably should. He's pretty good. A big thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon. You can join their ranks at patreon.com/lostincriterion. And hey, thank you for listening.